Hello, I'm Michael Serapio, and this is the Primetime Politics Podcast.
Tonight on Primetime Politics, weighing the options.
We are clearly pushing for a de-escalation.
G7 countries are calling on Israel to exercise restraint as the Netanyahu government promises retaliation for this weekend's attack from Iran. Coming up, we will speak with Israel's ambassador about options beyond a military counteroffensive. Also, Canada's ambassador to the United Nations, Bob Rae. With Iran's backing of groups like Hamas and Hezbollah, is it time to treat the country as a rogue state? And
it's a case that should have never been brought. It's an assault on America.
The first criminal trial of a former U.S. president gets underway in New York. This is Primetime Politics. Hello, everyone. I'm Michael Serapio. Israel says it will respond to Iran's attack in a manner and at a time of its choosing, refusing to rule out a military response while Western allies, including Canada, call for restraint. Over the weekend, Iran launched more than 300 missiles and drones toward Israel. The vast majority were shot down, some by Israeli aerial defense, others by the U.S., the U.K., France, and neighboring Jordan. As for Canada, the Foreign Affairs Minister says the Trudeau government is working on more sanctions against key members of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard, and currently is urging Israel to find victory in the number of missiles that were stopped from hitting their targets.
We think that it is important that Israel be able to protect itself. It has done so over the weekend, and we are clearly pushing for a de-escalation, and we need to make sure that the conflict doesn't extend to the region. So that is why I've been clear to my counterpart in Israel, please take the win and make sure that we can work together to bring back peace in the region.
Well, joining us now is Israel's ambassador to Canada, Ido Moed. Ambassador, thank you for coming to the studio again.
Thank you for having me.
So you just heard the foreign minister. She says the fact that the vast majority of missiles intended for Israel were stopped, she says that should be taken as a win, and this moment should be about de-escalating the situation. What's your response to that?
We've been trying to de-escalate this for a long time. Israel didn't choose to start this war, but we know that Iran will stop at nothing before they annihilate the state of Israel. They mean what they say, they act upon their words, and we have to understand that. When Iran hits us with hundreds of missiles, be it ground missiles or ballistic missiles, or be it UAVs, Israel will have to respond. In our neighborhood, there is a language that is sometimes, unfortunately, the language of force. And with Iran, that is developing nuclear capabilities, one has to be extremely careful in making sure that they understand that they will not attack Israel. We will not tolerate that.
Yet, in this moment, you are hearing Israel's traditional allies, Canada, the U.S., the U.K., France, Italy, all are asking for restraint. Is Israel willing to restrain in this moment? Or the opposite of that, willing to ignore what the allies are calling for?
We're extremely grateful for the international coalition that stands by Israel. As Prime Minister Trudeau also said, and also the head of the opposition, by the way, said very clearly they stand with Israel, with Israel's right to defend itself. But let it be very clear to everyone, we are the ones under attack. We are the ones that need to incur this barrage of rockets and ballistic missiles and whatever. This is a moment when the world has to understand that Iran does not understand diplomacy, does not understand any nuance. Iran is a very dangerous country that has developed a broad range of proxies with a very clear aim: annihilation of the state of Israel. We will not tolerate that. This has to be clear. And when they develop those proxies, and when they are using Hamas to attack Israel, where is Hezbollah waiting with more than 100,000 rockets that are aimed at Israel. Fortunately this time, it ended with a severe injury of a seven-year-old girl from the Arab population in Israel. Very unfortunate, but on the broader scale, we feel lucky. We feel that we outsmarted the Iranian enemy at this time. But we have to remember, this is a very serious situation, very volatile, and we have to make sure that Iran understands they this will not be tolerated.
Are you willing to go it alone, though? Because if the option and the response is military, we have heard from the United States that it will not be in the fight with Israel. Are you willing to go it alone against Iran if it comes to that?
We choose peace over war. We choose life over death. This is our way. We are trying to avoid any further escalation. But we have to understand that we are facing a very serious opponent this time, a war machine that was set up by the Ayatollah regime of Iran. We have nothing against the Iranian people, as we don't have anything against the Palestinian people. It's the Hamas, it's the Iranian Ayatollah regime that we have to fight. Those are the ones that want to eliminate the state of Israel. And they have shown the capability, and they have said they will repeat it again and again. So we have to be very strong and very adamant in our response to that.
So would economic sanctions be an appropriate response? Do you think that's enough? Because it seems to be when the G7 nations come together on a phone call over the weekend, that is what they're leaning on, more economic sanctions rather than military action against Iran.
I believe that Israel, like all other countries, would prefer not to have any kind of further escalation because we don't want any casualty, we don't want any bloodshed. But this is a very serious situation, as I said earlier. Sanctions against Iran are extremely important, but they are necessary right now. So the IRGC has to be designated immediately as a terrorist organization. Economic sanctions have to be put in place so that the industries that are manufacturing those missiles, those USVs, are not able to reproduce them and threaten the region again. But this is an initial step. Beyond that, Israel, along with its allies in the region and outside the region, will do its utmost to make sure that these kind of attacks never occur again. We will do as much as we can to make sure that that doesn't happen with any further damage to the region, but we have to be clear again, as I said in the beginning, it's extremely dangerous. They are out there to eliminate the state of Israel. This is an existential threat for Israel. Everybody understands that. It's a very serious situation. And so we will lay our moves forward as the time progresses. And we want to make sure, together with the international community, the message to Iran has to be very clear. Stop whatever you're doing. Stop threatening Israel. Stop aiming at Israel.
And as you noted, Iran does back several groups that are destabilizing to the region, Hezbollah being one, the other one being Hamas. And Hamas, of course, is the group that you find yourself in conflict right now with in Gaza. Will Iran's actions affect humanitarian corridors into Gaza?
Well, let me put it this way. Iran is trying to destroy Israel. Okay, it's very clear. They're using Hamas for that. They're using whatever means they have. Israel, at the same time, is broadening the potential and the platforms and the venues to facilitate aid to Gaza. When Iran is shooting these barrages of missiles against Israel, it's quite difficult for us to be able to provide whatever assistance we can to facilitate the flow of aid into Gaza Strip. It's also, by the way, very difficult for us to protect the whole country. And just imagine, I'm sure you remember the image of missiles almost falling on the Dome of the Rock, which is the third holiest place for Islam. Rockets that were shot from Iran, missiles that were shot from Iran. And protecting the Dome of the Rock with the Iron Dome of Israel is something that is very symbolic. Because what we want to achieve is peaceful coexistence with our neighbors. We have the Abraham Accord countries that understand that and stand by Israel also under these circumstances because they know exactly what we are standing for. We are not against the Palestinian people. We would like to provide as much aid as possible, but we have to fight off Hamas. We have to release 133 hostages being held in tunnels underneath the ground in Gaza Strip, and we have to make sure that Iran will not attack Israel again.
And does that necessarily affect humanitarian aid?
That can affect. We'll try as much as we can as we go along to facilitate more aid flowing into the Gaza Strip instead of lowering the numbers. We are working very hard to create more openings and to enlarge the capacity. But we know that also on the Palestinian side, much of the aid is still waiting because international organizations don't have the capacity either to deliver it or they have other constraints, be it Hamas slash UNRWA, be it other constraints. So as much as we can, we would like to allow this flow to go in from the air, from the sea, on the ground. But it's extremely complicated. Gaza Strip is run, still managed to great extent, unfortunately, by Hamas. Hamas is still there. And we have to make sure that Hamas is out of the picture so that also Gaza Strip can rebuild and can be actually released from the pressure, from the control of Hamas.
Ambassador Moed, I always appreciate the time. Thank you very much for it.
Thank you for having me.
Well, joining us now is Canada's Ambassador to the United Nations, Bob Rae. Ambassador Rae, thank you for making the time.
Thank you, Michael.
So it seems to be that Israel is signaling that any response will not be immediate. And by that, I'm really referencing Minister Benny Gantz here, who says that his country will exact the price when the timing is right. Do you interpret that as Israel exercising the restraint that Western allies are asking from it?
You know, I think this is just an ongoing issue. I don't think you can predict day by day what's going to happen. You know, I wish one could. I don't have the means to tell you what exactly. I think what it means is they're thinking about what to do, which is always better than not thinking about what to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole point of what I've been trying to say for many years is if you respond impulsively to an attack, you're just guaranteeing another impulsive attack on the other side. So you really got to think this thing through. And it's not just about Israel and Iran. It's about Israel and it's all of its neighbors, including Palestinians. And it's about Israel and all of those people on whom it relies to assist it. It's in its own defense. So I think there's room for conversations, which is better to have breathing space than not to have breathing space. But we have to keep coming back to this point that, of course, Israel is responsible for its own self-defense. But Israel's self-defense requires the assistance of others. So, yeah, if it means that Israel is prepared to talk to others, that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I do wonder, given that Iran does back these entities like Hamas and Hezbollah, and it has a term that has, it's a term rather that has been debated around Iran, but is it time that Canada treat Iran as a rogue state?
Well, the question is, what does that achieve exactly, Michael? I mean, at some point we have to engage Iran in a variety of ways. Yes, of course, they're a state that behaves in roguish behavior. What it does is unpredictable and roguish and brutal. They're brutal to their own population. They're brutal to their own people. They're brutal to women in their country. They're brutal to political dissidents. They're brutal to people of other religions like Baha'i. They have a history of terrible brutality, but the point is, there still has to be every effort made to ensure that we don't let our anger get in the way of making a clear-headed decision about what to do and how to do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how we have to be thinking: less about, you know, I can do more than you, or I'm tougher than you, or I'm stronger than you. You're going to do this; I'm going to go even further. Not about the rhetoric one hears in various, you know, assemblies and security councils and everywhere else. It's about doing what we actually believe is going to have a constructive, effective impact on deterring Iran from doing good things and, at the same time, not losing sight for a moment of the broader issue, which is the whole region, what's happening in Palestine, what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in all of the regions of the Middle East that need to be addressed on a clear-headed basis.
You use the terminology clear-headed, and you know Iran says that the missile attack that it engaged in was a defensive action, a response to this April the 1st attack on its embassy in Syria. The dead, as you know, included an Iranian general who reportedly ran covert military operations in both Syria and Lebanon. Was that an attack a mistake, do you think?
I think that there's a, if you wanted a distinction, Israel launched a very deadly attack against a small group of people that achieved its target. They broke a lot of rules in doing so. I mean, obviously, it's not in keeping with principles of diplomatic immunity because they attacked a diplomatic office in the heart of Damascus, but what Iran did was to launch hundreds of missiles, drones, everything else, all over Israel, including on top of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, totally indiscriminate, but also completely ineffective. I'll leave it to others to talk about what is the meaning of all this. But my own view is that Iran is still a very dangerous country. Its behavior is still represents a threat, certainly to the peace of the region and, in my view, the peace of the world. But at the same time, we have to think about our own responses and what we've been encouraged to do by way of their own responses, which have got a chance of success in a sustainable way. It's one thing to do something that makes you feel better. It's another thing to do something that's actually going to be of consequence and is going to be successful. And I think we have to keep our eye on that pretty critical distinction in public policy. We can all feel better because we've either said or done something. But if in fact it proves the next day to be not a good idea and have had a response that we could never have anticipated, then it hasn't been successful.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, I have less than a minute, but I do want to ask this of you, because the Israeli ambassador to Canada hears, it seems, when Canada says it stands with Israel, but what he says is that Canada has to show what it means by standing with Israel. So when you speak to the Israeli ambassador at the United Nations, when you speak to Israeli officials, what do you say to them about what Canada is willing to do to support the country?
Well, we want Israel's security to be sustainable. And that's the key thing. We don't believe that we can have a secure Middle East without a resolution of the conflict with the Palestinians that has gone unresolved for 75 years. We don't believe that the paths that Israeli has been pursuing of ignoring the problem or trying to deal with it in only a half-hearted way, that has got a hope in hell of succeeding. We just don't believe that. And we think we've seen the evidence of that tragically very recently. And therefore, we have been encouraging Israel to think about doing things that we think will actually create greater security for their country. At this point, the Israeli government doesn't agree with us. That's fine. But I do think there are a number of countries, as well as Canada, who feel very strongly in a two-state solution and who feel very strongly that a secure Israel is best protected by having a secure Palestinian state that is living alongside them in a state of peace and in a constructive way. People might say that's impossible, but I will tell you something else. It's impossible for the status quo to continue and to be successful. It has not led to Israeli security. Tell me how decisions that have been made in the last while have actually contributed to Israeli security. They haven't. And so we have to look and see, well, what more can we do that will create the conditions for Israel's security?
Ambassador Bob Rae, I always appreciate the time. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
To New York City now, where the first of four criminal trials facing Donald Trump got underway today. The former U.S. president and presumptive Republican nominee facing 34 counts of falsifying business records. It's a scheme that was allegedly devised to conceal a hush money payment to adult film star Stormy Daniels. Ms. Daniels alleges she had an affair with Donald Trump, one that he denies, and the state alleges the money was used to keep damaging information away from the American public ahead of the 2016 election.
This is political persecution. This is a persecution like never before. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. And again, it's a case that should have never been brought. It's an assault on America. And that's why I'm very proud to be here. This is an assault on our country.
Well, with more, we're now joined by Jessica Roth, who is a former U.S. federal prosecutor for the Southern District of New York. Ms. Roth, thank you for making the time today.
It's my pleasure to join you.
Listen, I wanted to start here with some context. You know, given that this case is up against more serious criminal indictments that the former president faces, how important is this case on its own merits and what it might teach us about the other cases still to come?
Well, I don't think anybody really expected that this would be the first case to go to trial among the four criminal cases that have been brought against the former president. But here we are. It was the first one that was filed. The district attorney who filed this case had expressed his willingness to postpone it while the federal cases that involve much more serious charges surrounding the January 6th insurrection and efforts to overturn the election results went forward. But those are on hold, at least the federal one in the District of Columbia. While the U.S. Supreme Court decides whether the former president has immunity from criminal prosecution. And the case involving the 2020 election in Georgia is also essentially on hold in the sense that the court is busy deciding various motions and hasn't scheduled a trial date. And the case in Florida involving national defense information also doesn't have a firm trial date, and the court there is also consumed with motions. So here we are. This one is going forward. The charges are far less serious than those in the other cases, but they involve falsification of business records with the intent to conceal another crime. And the way that the district attorney is framing this case, that other crime is allegedly efforts to influence the 2016 presidential election through donations that were essentially made by Michael Cohen to President Trump's campaign in the form of payments to Stormy Daniels, who alleged she had had an affair with the former president. And the payments were to keep her quiet so that the public would not know about that information on the eve of the election and right after the so-called Access Hollywood tape had been revealed when the Trump campaign was in full damage control mode. So the basis for these state charges in New York is that Trump, working with others, falsified the records of the Trump Organization to conceal that they were, in fact, reimbursing Michael Cohen for these payments to Stormy Daniels that the district attorney says amounted to unlawful campaign donations because they exceeded the amounts that an individual was permitted to donate to the campaign. Mm-hmm. So there we have it. It's actually in some ways fairly complex and in some ways fairly straightforward.
Well, you know, to all of that, though, complex or straightforward, Donald Trump has described this trial and all others that he faces as Democrats weaponizing the justice system to impede his reelection. So how does the court proceed to ensure that is not the public impression? Do the courts even care?
Well, this court is going to be very careful in selecting jurors. One of the things I think that's notable about the jury selection process that is now just underway is that the court is not going to be asking the potential jurors which political party they affiliate with, if they do, or for whom they cast a vote in the last two presidential elections, if they voted. So the court's going to be making an effort to not make this about politics, but rather to discern whether or not the jurors who are ultimately chosen can be fair and impartial in deciding this case and rendering a verdict based solely on the evidence that will be presented in court and the arguments that will be presented by counsel. So what's going to be happening in front of the jurors in this courtroom is going to be all about the evidence, all about the facts, with a real effort to keep the politics out of it. I think that's going to be a challenge for the court to maintain those limits. And for the prosecution, it is likely going to be the former president's effort and his lawyer's effort to bring the politics in. But it's been quite clear in pretrial filings and orders that the court is going to make every effort to keep the politics out.
Well, almost guaranteed we'll be getting daily, hourly, if not up to the minute commentary from the former U.S. president here. But, you know, if convicted in this case, he does, Donald Trump, face 4 years in jail at most. You said state charges. Is this a crime that he can forgive himself if he becomes the U.S. president?
No, he can't. I mean, that's part of the federal system in the United States, is that the U.S. president, although he could, in theory, order his attorney general to stop a federal prosecution, and although in theory he could try to pardon himself if he were convicted, or even frankly before he were convicted of federal charges, he does not have that power with respect to charges brought by state prosecutors. And so that is quite important to note as this case goes forward, that even if he were elected president, he would not be able to pardon himself from any conviction in these charges.
Okay, you say even if he were to be elected U.S. president, does that mean then this trial could last beyond the next U.S. vote?
I don't expect that this particular trial in New York that's just underway now will last beyond 2 months. I mean, that the current estimate is about 6 weeks. It could be 2 months, but that would still be comfortably before the November election. It's not clear at all, however, that any of the other three pending criminal cases against the former president will get to trial before the November election. So this could be it.
This could be it. But if he is convicted, would it disqualify him in any way from the presidential race?
No. I mean, it's one of the fascinating features of U.S. law is that there's actually no legal disqualification from running or holding the presidency for somebody who's been convicted of a crime, even a felony. There are political consequences, potentially, in terms of whether people would vote for somebody who's been convicted of a felony. But legally, there's no bar. There would be very important issues that would have to be worked out if he were, in fact, convicted and sentenced to some form of incarceration, about whether that could go forward once he was elected to office, if he were, and sworn in. I think most people who have looked into this have come to the conclusion that it would not be possible for him to be incarcerated, especially under a state sentence, if he were president, because it would infringe on his performance of his constitutional duties. So essentially, as a separation of powers issue and a supremacy clause issue, it would be impossible for courts to rule that he should be detained while president. But the situation has never arisen before in our history, and it's hard to imagine getting to that point.
Jessica Roth, of course, we're watching from north of your border, but thank you for this. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
And, of course, we'll continue to bring you coverage on the trial as it proceeds in New York. Meanwhile, back in this country, the federal finance minister chose a new pair of shoes today. And while some may think that does not merit any kind of coverage, it is a uniquely Canadian tradition of finance ministers choosing a new pair of shoes to wear for the tabling of a new budget. And often there is symbolism involved. For example, Paul Martin wore work boots. Jim Flaherty just had old shoes resold. And for Chrystia Freeland in 2024, well, she chose a pair of black leather heels made by the Maguire Shoe Company. That's a company out of Montreal that does a direct-to-home business and was started by two sisters. So you can watch for those shoes tomorrow as we bring you special coverage of the federal budget right here on CPAC. And that is our show for this Monday. For everyone here at CPAC, I'm Michael Serapio. Thank you for watching. Of course, we will be back tomorrow for the federal budget special. But up next, Omaira Issa avec l'essentiel.